Hi, my name's Luke Bache, and welcome to Movers, Shakers, and Social Changers. In this podcast, I speak to people who have had a profound impact on many people's lives, including my own. These are people who I consider pioneers in their respective fields, and who I truly believe are stepping into this new story of interconnectivity, compassion, and presence. Hey everyone, welcome to today's conversation where I talk to the journalist Indra Shekhar Singh, who has been covering the Indian farmers revolution. He's been going in and living in the kind of Occupy movement, which is the largest Occupy movement, I believe, in human history, involving around 5 million people, where they have said no to big agriculture and the Modi government basically stripping them of their rights. This conversation, Indra's writings have moved me to kind of tears of almost joy in that realization that we are so incredibly powerful as human beings when we unite in a cause from the heart. Hope you enjoy.
So they are using Gandhian ways of revolution, which is every man or every woman is coming and contributing whatever they can. I can contribute through my words, I can contribute through my physical labor, and that's what I'm doing. And there are other people, you know, you will not believe it, but there are policemen. It's got a lot of police deployment. So police people who come and do surveillance at day actually go back and provide donations to the farmer revolution at night each month, or when their payday comes, they're actually reporting on those guys, and they are so moved from the inside that when their payday arrives, they are paying a share of their salary freely to them, to the farmers. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Indra, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
Good.
Nice to see you. Thanks for joining.
Yeah.
So the context that I wanted to set is that there's a lot of kind of turbulence in the world right now. And I think there's a lot of things being passed in governments under the guise of COVID. And I think at some point, the general populations are potentially going to say, no, this is enough. And for me, just from very much the outside, it seems that this farmers' revolution, if we want to call it protest, however we want to label it, is kind of a defining moment where a huge mass of population, of people, have said enough and come together seemingly non-violently to stand for their work, for nature, for their dignity, all these wonderful things that we need as human beings. And I truly believe that if this echo can kind of reverberate, which I'm sure it's doing on some level anyway, but I would like to just bring more attention to it because the media hasn't been covering it so much, the mainstream media. So I would love to hopefully spread anything about this story that really has inspired me through your writings. So how does that sound to you?
Great. So I think I should just begin by talking about the three farm laws which were introduced in 2020. So what happened in India, and now this may sound, it may sound all right, but it is not, that in 2020, using COVID as a shield, the Narendra Modi government began an agenda of deep corporatization. Such corporatization that even if Mussolini was alive, he'd feel shy of the things that Modi has done in India. Now, apart from disinvestment, like even more than what Yeltsin did in Russia, you see, Modi has privatized all the Indian public assets, all the public industry, India being one of the socialist countries who still have industry owned by the public. he first disinvested in all of them. And a critical part of this piece was the unprotection or the disruption of Indian agriculture, which was protected by the Indian constitution. And Modi government has now finally unleashed a new company Raj. Now, the company Raj refers to the time when the British controlled India. So what he did is he said, now corporations can once again enter the agriculture sector. What that means is he brought about three laws. The first law being that now farm gate sales were allowed. So farmers could sell directly to corporations, number one. Number two.
Can you tell me the ramifications of each one as well as you say them? In
course.
So yeah, if farmers sell to corporations, what does that mean for farmers?
Of course. See, that I would then go off on a different tangent, but I'll do that for you. See, earlier, like I said, the East India Company, which was the world's first transnational corporation, forced farmers using for contracts, you know, just very one-sided contracts to tell them that you have to grow this. And if you don't grow this, we will kill you. Because at that time, the world, they never saw dark people like from India as humans. You know, there was a whole Africa slave trade where Africans were considered as chattel, and anybody who's not white was not even considered human. Sure. So keep that in mind, and that's the nature of how these people came to India, and they started making contracts for to them. They were making contracts with monkeys and barbarians and savages, you see. So our lives didn't matter, our earths didn't matter, you see. Mm-hmm. And the Indian constitution makers knew this, that how a corporation can kill off a country. So they said the corporation should not be in direct touch with the farmer. There should be an intermediary level, which regulates that transaction, which is a government-regulated thing so that the farmer is once again not cheated. You know, keep in mind that 70% of the population of this country of India is farmers, and 86% of them don't even own more than 2 acres of land. You know, 2 acres is nothing. So out of the 700 million or the 800 million people that are living, that are farming in India, 86% of them don't even own 2 acres of land.
So
just imagine that.
So, yeah, I mean, I was amazed when I read that within your article. So within that, previously Indian farmers had been protected, and of course, rightly so, by government. So when they were selling their produce, that they were negotiating with fairer contracts and deals and were protected. And now that first law has been passed, they're basically at the mercy of large corporations who can kind of lock them into contracts, which is basically, from my understanding, what happened in America as well. That's probably
exactly right. Now, when you say that, that's the second law. The second law allows for companies to enter into legally valid contracts with the farmers, which was earlier not allowed. You had to go through a government channel or a government-regulated market yard to buy from farmers. So see, the government was not only thinking for the farmers, but also thinking for the local trader, you know, who's sitting at the village level or who's in rural India. The world, you have to also take care of them. You can't just let them be, right? So India has also a very strong population which is engaged in small trading, small and medium trading. So the government was also thinking for them and their livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And that's why they were also protected. And that it was something called the APMC, which is an agriculture produce market yard system, market yard corporation, and then council, which led to the market yard. So they said, now that is finished. That the government, the third law which comes in, which allows for private mandis or private market yards to function in the country. Earlier, only government-regulated mandis or market yards could sell farm produce. Now, private markets have been introduced. And mind you, that these private market yards are also tax-free. So similar like in America. Now, let me take an American example where companies like Cargill not only own the seed or the final produce, but they also own the crediting services. They also own the silos. They also own the transportation services. They also own everything from the seed to the market. Okay? So these are the two basic laws. And then the third one that they've done is they've allowed for unlimited hoarding of food and harvest material. So in India, there was again, as India got independent, we understood that food was an essential commodity. It was not like any other product in the market. It is not a mere commodity, but it is an essential commodity, which is necessary for the nation's security. And it is also necessary for just livelihood in human life. So you cannot make it an object of the marketplace. And hence, many of these food items were put under this special act of the Indian Constitution, and nobody could hoard them or keep unlimited supplies in their godowns or warehouses. Okay, so the government now has removed that limit, and now anybody in India can hoard as much as they want to keep. This is actually allowing for the Cargillization of India. This is exactly how in the 1980s, when the American farm prices fell and American farmers were dying and there were foreclosures all over America, four corporations in America made a killing. They made Christmas, it was Christmas for them in March and April, and then all throughout the year. It was that good for them. And since the 1980s, the American corporation has not only eaten up and hoarded America's wealth and America's grain, but also the world's grain. And that's why these four corporations, control about 80% of the world's grains right now.
I mean, I think this almost needs just a moment of pause just for people to like really listen into that, right? 80% of the world's grains are owned by four companies. I mean, that is absolutely terrifying to me that four companies have that much power. And so if I kind of just summarize, these laws have basically really taken away protections for Indian farmers that were deliberately put in after what had happened previously and were put in when India, I don't like the word gain because it should took back its independence because it didn't gain it, it already had it, it took it back, took back its independence. And not only are the contract thing with corporations been changed, but now corporations can come in and dictate what seeds are grown, probably the kind of pesticides used, and that companies can now hoard seeds, which will of course affect market price of other farmer seeds and so on. So basically all protection just been torn away very quickly.
Okay. Yes. And not only hoard seeds, but they can hoard any food produce, whether it be rice, wheat, corn, or meat, or other legumes that we eat, or millets, they can hold any amount of any food crop and then use that to manipulate. So while all this is happening, certain Indian corporations have already built up, you know, one corporation alone has built up storage capacity of 8 million metric tons. Can you imagine? That's a lot of grain. That's a lot of that. That's a storage capacity that can feed all of Scandinavia. Can you imagine? Not just Sweden, but all of Scandinavia can be fed by that corporation who has so much of storing capacity.
And this was, you know, as you said, this was passed last year, and already that corporation has built that premises, right?
They started building in 2018. Can you imagine that, Luke? So they started building since 2018. And in 2020, the rules were passed, and everyone thought that it's happened haphazardly, or it's happening just in keeping COVID in mind. But people who've actually dug deeper have found out that all the corporations that the government wants to favor have already done it. And hence, I quoted Mussolini, that Mussolini would even be shy, because fascism is the real marriage between corporations and political power or the state. So here you've already foreseen that there will be a COVID response, or there will be a COVID crisis in the future. See, that is the real scary part.
Yeah, I mean, not to go off topic too much, but with this whole vaccine passports, they were already being discussed by the EU conveniently before this pandemic as well. But anyway, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but case in point. But okay, so when these laws were passed, I would love to hear about how this revolution began then, because from what I've read and heard from you, it sounds like it kind of trickled down, and then farmers from across India basically started to kind of walk across India and gather more and more people to join them. So I'd love to hear about the kind of movement that happened when these laws were passed.
Yes. So this is, I think, the revolution of our times. No matter where you're watching this, where you're living, this is the revolution of our times. Because immediately as the laws were passed, this is, I'm talking about June, that's when the first ordinances came out. Indian farmers were very quick to understand that this will unleash a new wave of corporatization. So it began in the Indian state of Punjab, which has a very active farmer union network. And they started, keep in mind that there's COVID all over the place. People, there were lockdowns, there were people not meeting each other. There was a fear psychosis which was taking over the planet. And yet these organizers went to every village, they went to every province, and they started collecting not only farmers, but also donations, supplies, and getting the peace army ready to march towards Delhi. So every farmer, every village contributed something. They had to keep in mind that when the farmers go, who is going to tend to their land? Who is going to cut the harvest? Because see, they've been here now 5-6 months. They've been here, I think, 120-125 days in Delhi, and they started the march 4-5 months ago. You see, so it took them another month to reach Delhi, and they've been in Delhi for 4 months. Wow. So I would imagine a time period of 6 months. So you had to plan all this out. So they started doing that. They collected funds. They talked to everybody. They got the farmers together. They got women, even women, older men, people who are way above 60. And they started walking from Punjab into Haryana, which is a neighboring state between Punjab and Delhi. And what happened then was that the police was very cold for India, temperatures reaching 1 degree Celsius. I know that's nothing compared to what you get in Sweden. No,
still, sure.
But for India, it's pretty cold.
Yeah, sure.
And these people are elderly people, and they are women who were basically, the water cannons were used on them. Many of them died because of the cold while they were marching from Punjab into Haryana, where they also met with police batons, where the police also had dug up roads, put barricades, and used all the nasty tactics they could use to stop this army from reaching Delhi. But as the earth was on their side, they broke through every barricade. They braved the cold winter and the water cannon, and they marched further to Delhi's border. Finally, when they reached Delhi after in a period of a month's time,
and what numbers are we talking, Indra? Sorry to interrupt, but what numbers, just to give kind of a visualization for people to understand, how many people do you imagine this was?
I would imagine about 2 million people.
Yeah.
2 million people on the march from Punjab into Delhi. And just, again, going off on a different tangent, but in the past 4 months, I think 4-5 million people have come and encamped at Delhi's borders. Many of them have gone back to kind of finish their harvest and other stuff. So this is the scale of the protest just at Delhi. We're not talking about other states right now. Just in New Delhi, 5 million people have come and gone.
And I mean, this might be, who knows, I have not researched the biggest movement in the history of humanity, but I can't imagine there has been a bigger movement than this, 5 million people.
Yes.
Right.
You're absolutely correct. This is the world's largest Occupy movement, the largest farmers' strike, the largest union strike ever to have happened.
Okay, so these 5 million people have come into Delhi. Sorry to have interrupted.
So now what happened is they came and they encamped at 4 borders. You know, there are these arterial highways that enter Delhi. And they caught the northern road, which is at Singhu border, then at Tikri border, which is the western main road coming to Delhi, then at Ghazipur, and another road at Chila border, which was entering Delhi from another neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh. And there's another protest site, which is on the Rajasthan-Haryana border. I'll get to that part later, but just talking about the farmers continuing the march from Delhi. So they came here, most of them were walking, but many of them were also in their tractors and trolleys. You know, that became the symbol of the revolution, a tractor and a trolley. And in that trolley, 15 people, every trolley had 10 to 15 people who lived on it, who carried their ration in it, who slept in it. And wherever the police stopped them, they encamped right then and there. Once they reached Delhi's border, they encamped on the highway. So the Tikri border today, as of today, spreads over 35 kilometers. Can you imagine 35 kilometers of all along the highway? People are encamped. They're sleeping in makeshift tents. They have their own toilet facility. It's like a mini city, which is encamped on Delhi's borders. So that's the scale of it. And when they reached here, of course, they had nothing. They were being supplied. They had an excellent system of supply and logistics. So the food was coming in from Punjab, the neighboring villages. And even today, if you go there, the neighboring villages get fresh vegetables, get fresh milk, buttermilk and other yogurt and other stuff for them every day. They've now even started getting reverse osmosis plants fixed there, like, you know, in a temporary settlement. They're digging, they're digging tube wells so that they can get a fresh supply of water. So they're highly organized. They have medical camps and they have every, for example, every five or six tents will have one free food langar. That's what they're called in Hindi and in Punjabi. It's basically like a community dinner service where anybody can come and have a free hot meal.
I mean, yeah, again, I would love to just reflect on this, that people gathered and walked, I'm imagining hundreds of kilometers, if not miles, together, and people of all ages, over 60s, both genders, and gathered and have built an Occupy movement of 35 kilometers that local villages are coming in and feeding them, and they have free food for people who I heard you say before that might not have ever eaten three meals a day in their life, that this Occupy movement is kind of supporting everyone. It's not just about the farmers, right? And I think that's what really deeply touches my heart, that of course they're standing for their livelihood, their dignity, the protection of the earth, but they're actually expanding that kind of lovingness to feed anyone that is coming in to the
Yes, and I'll go deeper in that, you know, because that is something that moved me too. But before I do that, keep in mind that that's just the one protest. The 35 kilometers is a Tikri border. There are other borders also which are as long. So wow. it's not just one place which is 35 kilometers. There are other places at Singhu border, at Ghazipur, and at the Rajasthan border. Again, there are people encamped. And what they are doing is beyond the mind. It's beyond the brain. It's something to do with the heart. And now I'll delve into what you talked about. See, in India, we've been looted. We've been exploited, not just by the colonial powers, but the residue sahabs that they've left. So that is the kind of force that these people are fighting against. And how are they fighting this force? They are fighting this force with love. Now there are these rag pickers, you know, these people who have nothing. You look at their faces, children who don't know who their parents are. They're orphans from the street. They're malnourished. They have spots on their faces. Their hair is not of the right color because due to malnutrition, they suffer from all kinds of diseases. And no hygiene, no health, they have nothing. I can't even explain this to you, but they are people who jump into a pile of garbage so that they can pick out plastic from it. They are so destitute. What you and I would think is a hotbed for infection and contagion, like basically just infection and filth. For them, they are so desperate that they would jump in. Imagine a six-year-old jumping into a garbage bag, trying to pick out plastic that he or she can then resell. That's the level of destitution and desperation, really. So these people, these children and their mother and their families and whoever is taking care of them started to come and visit the farmer protest because the farmers were giving them free food. They said, you come and have free food with us. So it's the first time, like I mentioned earlier also, that thousands of these children have had a hot meal on New Year's, three hot meals on New Year's. They've had a hot meal for the past 125 days. The farmers have encamped there. And not only hot meals, but all the plastic that's been wasted and all the other things that the farmers use and discard, these children pick that up and sell it to the other recyclers. So it's also created a new ecosystem of, and I think the best description for this is of a gift economy. You see, today, even if I go there today and I have nothing, I will be given clothes, I will be given a place to sleep, and I would be given love. People, I've been traveling the country, and I'll speak about that part a little later, but my time at the protest, rather the revolution, because people I've never known, people who could have never met me, and I could have never met them. We met like brothers. And of course, no one was wearing masks. No one was sanitizing their hands, and no one was saying that you don't touch me, don't come near me. Everyone was just hugging each other. Can you imagine after a year of lockdown and fear, people just embracing you? That's, and people you've never met, people you don't know, they treat you as their own. You sleep next to them, they make you eat from the same plate. You wash together, you eat together, you live together, you share your stories, you share your pain, and you share the vision for the future together. I was moved personally by this. This was a life-changing experience for me.
I imagine. And have you actually spent much physical time down there then, Indra? I know you've written about it.
Of course. I couldn't have been moved to write so much without having spent time there. So I've spent many nights at the Tikri border. I spent Holi, which is one of the major festivals in North India, at the border with the farmers. That's all I do. If I'm in Delhi, I'm spending time at either one of the borders. Of course, there are 3-4 locations, so I keep shifting from one to the other. Mm-hmm. But that's what I keep doing. Mm-hmm. You go there, and I also do seva there. So seva basically means a kind of service. Mm-hmm. So you go there, you wash dishes, you basically help the elderly, you clean the streets, and that's how the revolution is being built. So they are using Gandhian ways of revolution, which is every man or every woman is coming and contributing whatever they can. I can contribute through my words. I can contribute through my physical labor. And that's what I'm doing. And there are other people, you know, you will not believe it, but there are policemen. It's got a lot of police deployment. So police people who come and do surveillance at day actually go back and provide donations to the farmer revolution at night each month. Or when their payday comes, they're actually reporting on those guys. And they are so moved from the inside that when their payday arrives, they are paying a share of their salary freely to them, to the farmers. People have donated everything. Like can you imagine some big pop stars and big people who sing and who are celebrities are actually down there sweeping the roads. That's the kind of momentum and the mood the farmer revolution has created.
I mean, it really genuinely brought tears to my eyes when you said about the police, because I think that says it all, right? The people who, and I'm definitely not vilifying police, but they're in a position where they're being paid, and so it's their livelihood too, right, to oppose it. And the fact that the movement is clearly based in, as I keep saying, about the earth and about love and about a gift economy, as you said, and about savor, which is service, it's obviously moving people so much. And I think this is what I want to speak to. I think this is why all the movements that are in our memory, Gandhi's, Martin Luther King, that are about love, are the ones that stand the test of time, because I know in my heart that's what humans, that's our innate nature. We are born to serve to a greater cause. And when we're doing that, as you said, pop stars, celebrities, whoever it is, I'm sure when they're coming in and sweeping or tidying, nothing will give them more fulfillment than that, right? To stand for a cause such as this. So I think that's, yeah.
You know, just think about, you talk about Martin Luther King, but let's talk about Jesus for a minute. What is the one key message coming out of all his teachings? It's about loving the wretched of the world. It's about loving everybody. You see? I think that's what I get from him. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. It's not about revenge. It's not about vengeance. It's not about one true God. It's about love.
Absolutely.
So, and that's why, you know, then let's talk about another aspect of this, which has not been talked about, that now a nation is awakening. So it's not just farmers who are encamped at the Delhi's border, and that's why it's no longer a protest, but it's a revolution. Mm-hmm. Because I've spent the last month not only at the borders, but also traveling all over the country. You know, I've just been to Modi's home state, which is Gujarat. Before that, I was in Karnataka, which is in South India. And before that, Rajasthan, Haryana, Punjab. And I've been traveling with the farmer leaders, talking to people who are not in Delhi and understanding what they feel about this. I've seen massive rallies of 10 to 25,000 people who come. Again, all of them are maskless. There is no social distancing. People are just people like they were before the lockdown. And they're all coming out in support of the farmers. They know exactly what the government is doing. But see, we may think that, oh, farmers don't know anything. Well, when you're taking the farmers' land away, you're taking their livelihood away. They exactly know what you're doing to them, because their interest is hampered with your decision. You see, this is no longer an idea, or no longer a political kind of maneuvering or a political tactic, but this is an ultimate sacrifice of the farmers to protect not just themselves, but protect our nation and the future of this country. You rightly said in the beginning that they've not only got the farmers' cause, but they've joined every other cause into this revolution. So government workers whose pensions have been taken away. In fact, the revolution even talks about police reform. Can you imagine that? The leaders have repeatedly told the government that we want police reform, which means that the police should be better paid. That means that the police should have a decent place to live. In India, still, the policemen get government accommodation. So the leaders have said, well, you make them work. You make our own brothers who are basically, and see, let me just go back a little bit. So the farmer thinks in this way, that the farmer is farming on the field, whereas the farmer's brother or the farmer's son is fighting on the borders. The farmer's son or the farmer's brother or sister is in the police force. So it's basically, it's a family. It's the farmer family. One of them is farming and one of them is wearing the uniform, no matter what color. So and you, the government, have actually put brother against brother or sister against father. That's what the government is doing right now. So the farmer revolution has made it very, very clear that we want police reform, we want privatization to stop, and this is no longer about farmers only. We are not going to go away till the time the country as a whole is not treated right, is not treated fairly.
Wow. I had no idea about that. I mean, and this is it. Like you said, this is not a protest, because I think a lot of protests, I don't know, I don't want to judge, but I think can be an opposition to something rather than a pro to something. And it seems that this revolution now, as you said, is, of course, there was a moment that kicked it off with the laws, but now it seems to have just stirred this deep humanitarian aspect that, yes, it's about us, but also, as you said, it's about the farmers. It's about everyone given a fair hey, or a fair life, a fair chance at life, right? So yeah, no wonder people are serving this. This sounds just like a pro-life movement, pro-equality.
And pro-humanity movement. I will even further to say pro-humanity. And it even exposes the whole corona agenda. Like, you know, what are we talking about? Like, if the disease was so virulent as people make it out to be, why aren't farmers dying? You know, that's the big question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I am not a virologist, which I've stated many times. I don't know anything about the medical profession. I don't know anything about diseases. But what I do know is what I see and what I hear and what I know to be fact by seeing and true justified belief. That the farmers who've been encamped here for the past 125 days, none of them have died from corona. There are no containment zones. There is no fever. There is no complications or symptoms, corona-like symptoms among these camps. And it's not me who's saying this, but the doctor is saying this.
Yeah,
I'm not denying that there is a corona. I'm sure there is a corona, whatever that is, but that it's not as dangerous as people are making it out to be.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you said that because I think it's easy to dismiss anything with this agenda right now. So I'm glad you said that. If people think, oh, they're being irresponsible, that I'm happy that you've also expanded to that. And I mean, they've been there for 4 months, right? How do you see this thing going, really? Because it sounds like it's not going to end until this revolution has spread into the doors of power. I can't see them just moving away. So how do you see this going, really? It's been 4 months, right?
Yes. And the government, the Indian farmer leaders have said that this will continue until December. And if needed, even more. So how this will end, and this is an appeal to everyone watching this, no matter where you're watching this will end with your support. Once people of the world come together and say that we support the Indian farmers. Now, I know Greta did a great thing by talking about it, but because of that, you know, Greta was not in jail, but people who supported her in India were thrown in prisons.
I saw that today.
So we need international pressure. We need people to write to their Indian embassies. We need people to reach out to farmers. We need people, everyone, to at least make a pledge to themselves that we need to talk about the Indian farmer revolution for at least 10 days with our friends. I'm no big fan of social media. If you don't, you want to use it, don't use it. But put real conversation time into the Indian farmer revolution. Give it your good energies, and that is how it will end. I feel with all of us forces combined, all our good energies and our good vibrations combined, we shall overtake this and we shall overcome this for the first time. Because if a will of 5 million people or millions of farmers who for whatever reason cannot be at the revolution but are still protesting in their homes, in their districts, is subdued, no matter what country you're from, what nation you're from, what color of your skin is, you are next.
I fully agree. This is, for me, a moment of a tipping point that has started in India. And I hope that this revolution is showing us the way of community, of being together in community and standing for how we want the world to be, because this rhetoric of returning to a normal with COVID, normal was not okay for me. Normal was inequality growing, climate, environmental destruction growing at ever increasing pace, depression, suicide, loneliness, you name it. So I really hope that this is this tipping point, both physically, politically, and I'm going to go like metaphysically, energetically, that this love reverberation of humanity's call, as you said, just spreads. So I'm deeply touched, really. I mean, is there any other thing that you want to say, Indra, or that people can do? I really appreciate that you said, even if people aren't on social media, just to like sit down and chat about it, just to get it into the public conscious, that this is happening, right? Because mainstream media just haven't covered it. It just has not been covered. And, you know, I saw this, I've been reading your articles, a Vice video showing how that, you know, there's so many women there and they're being encouraged by the Indian government to go. And I don't want to ever allude to anyone's intentions, but I think it's harder and harder for people to tolerate if violence happens against a group of unarmed females. So I think that's potentially, well, who knows? I don't want to allude to anything, but, you know, and I saw that walls have now been built around to try and blockade the revolution in. So, yeah, maybe just, as you said, I just hope people who listen to this share it, chat about it. And yeah, is there anything else you feel you want to say, Indra?
Final words, I say don't believe me. I say do not trust me even. Like the Buddha said, find your own facts yourself. So please, people who are watching this in Sweden or in Scandinavia, find out who owns your supermarkets. I'll tell you that 4 people own all the supermarkets in Sweden, 4 major corporations. Just understand your own system of agriculture and how food comes to you. And you will see what Indian farmers are fighting for. You will see the state of the Swedish farmer, see the state of the Scandinavian farmer, see why farming is important. You need to go back to your own roots and understand why for your people, farming was a thing. Why they wanted land and why they wanted to farm, and they were branching out to new countries to farm, looking for farmland. You know, Indian people, for us, land is our mother. And for the farmers, it is a religious duty to farm. It's not just an occupation. We are still connected to the earth. I want all of you to go out to your garden, smell the soil in your garden. I hope it's free of glyphosate, but just smell it, feel it, and know that we are fighting for that sweet smell of soil, those sweet smell of organic soil, you know. That's what we are fighting for. We're fighting for our mother and saving her from a corporate auction.
And this is what we've actually done around the world with this whole COVID thing. People have actually gone into their garden because we know this is a natural way to be. People have been gardening. People have been reaching out to their family and their friends. And yeah, I would love to finish with a reflection, and then I'll offer a time for you to reflect on this conversation. But I'm deeply humbled talking to you. And my reflection is that we are incredibly powerful beings. And when we stand for equality, for love, for nonviolence, for gifting, then our innate quality to serve others shines through. And that's when we are alive as human beings, when we're love, when we are the love that we naturally are, when we're serving someone or a greater intention. So I'm so touched that I got to talk to you and hear about this revolution. Thank you, Indra. That's my reflection.
Thank you. I think you've summed it up rather well, and that's what I feel in my heart. In the end, we are all brothers and sisters living on our Mother Earth. And if we don't realize this, there are forces which are coming to get us anyways. So we need to connect, leave out the boundaries, finish off the distinctions, and be one, hold each other's hands, and let the love energy flow.
Thanks very much for listening. If this episode moved you in any way and you'd like to share, or if you'd like to request a guest that has deeply inspired you, then I'd love to hear from you at moversandshakerspod@gmail.com. This episode and the lovely music was produced and edited by Ivan Lupaka, who you can also follow at Ivan the DJ on Instagram and social media. Thanks. Take care.